The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Coming up on this week's show. Pre-season gets underway in earnest. Sorry, in Austria. The CEO search is over with Darren Eales joining from Major League Soccer outfit Atlanta United. And NUFC's iconic physio Derek Wright joins the show as he bids farewell after a mind-bending 38 years at the club. Hello chaps, how the devil are we? Chris Woff over there in that Austria, well you're in Germany technically aren't you, but you've been in that Austria, and George Corgan as well in your house. Not as glamorous as Chris, but how are we doing, are we alright?
I am good, thank you, other than I seem to be holed up in someone else's hotel room if the hotel staff's reaction to me this morning is anything to go by. I got the room last night very late, it was after midnight, and there were two macarons wrapped up nicely in a letter to a Frau, I can't remember her name. And then I came down for breakfast this morning, gave my room number, and the waitress went away and then ran back about 5 minutes later and said, what is your name? You need to pay at reception. So I think I might be in the wrong hotel room, but other than that, yes, it's been a very, very enjoyable trip. Thank you.
Yes, and I'm okay. Well, I've just had a night of no sleep in the broiling heat of northeast England. To put that in Newcastle terms, I'm hotter than Callum Wilson's smile. Put it that way. I'm hotter than
That is hot.
I'm hotter than a Joe Willock goal scoring streak.
You're not very good at this, are you, George?
I'm hotter than Mike Ashley's underpants.
Oh, I don't want to think about that. Oh.
How are you, Taylor?
I'm all right. It's the same for me though. I was awake about 5 a.m. this morning. The heat is stifling already. And yesterday I just lay, like, you know when you see one of those lizards in Spain that just lies on a rock,
yeah,
and it's just fucked because it's too hot to do anything. That was me yesterday.
Well, come on, look, this teases us up nicely for some red hot soccer chat.
Absolutely. Well, pre-season, it's begun in earnest, hasn't it? Newcastle have played 1860 Munich and Mainz. A 3-0 win against 1860 Munich and a 1-0 defeat against Mainz. Chris, you were over there. What's the feeling like over in Austria and in the camp?
It's been, you can see that the players have really enjoyed themselves across, well, they came back last night, so this is Tuesday morning. I'm speaking to you, they flew back after the Mainz game. They were staying near a place called Salfelden in a really nice hotel complex. They've been travelling around on e-bikes everywhere, so they arrived at training all zooming in. Amazing. On their e-bikes. I bumped into Kieran Trippier in the middle of town the other day. He was just sitting around in his e-bike. They've all just been really enjoying themselves doing that. They've had a bit of downtime, but go-karting and the likes. Hang on a second.
Doesn't e-bikes absolutely spoil the entire purpose of pre-season training? They're supposed to get fit. They're being taken around the place on electric bikes.
Yeah, I imagine like old school managers would probably sort of absolutely despise the concept of it.
Wow.
Brian Clough would hate an e-bike, wouldn't he?
What's going on?
They've played two matches out in Austria. They played near Salfelden where they were staying on Friday against 1860 Munich, and then they played Mainz on Monday. But on the Sunday, we got invited to go and watch about half an hour of training, which was a really intense session. It was a sort of pressing drill, and you can see exactly what they're working on. And Eddie Howe dropped a couple of F-bombs in it when he got a bit angry with how the players were performing. Eddie Howe, who, by the way, is looking extremely buff. He's definitely been working out, and he looks like he's definitely bulked up.
Right.
And then we went to the hotel, we spoke to Howe, had a sit-down with Howe, and then I had a sit-down with Nick Pope, which will come out in The Athletic in the course of the next few weeks. Other journalists spoke to other players, and they've been really accommodating. You can see that they've got through a heck of a lot of work, but also I think they've really enjoyed themselves. Usually when you come to pre-season camps, you get a bit of a murmuring of, the players haven't enjoyed this, they've had nothing to do. But I think that they've enjoyed both the hard work and the fact that there was beautiful scenery and they had the opportunity to have free time. And so I could see Newcastle potentially coming back here in the future, even though it was very much a last-minute thing, a recommendation of a backroom staff member who used to be at Liverpool once the Ohio Cup was cancelled as to where they could go. But I think that they've really liked what they've seen, and I think they've got through a heck of a lot of work.
Absolutely stunning backdrop for that 1860 Munich game as well, wasn't it? I was watching that on the TV on NUFC.com, .co.uk, sorry, ooh, Floridian slip. And it was a stunning stadium and an absolutely incredible setting that game was played in, wasn't it, Chris? It looked beautiful.
It was beautiful. That was about a 20-minute walk from where we were staying in Selfieldon. So it's actually Christian Ziegler manages the team who are there, who play there.
Wow.
He's been there a few years, so former Premier League footballers, I'm sure many will remember, FC Pingzhou, I think they're called. But it was Newcastle's first pre-season friendly that wasn't behind closed doors. There was a big gate said the weekend before. Then 1860 Munich are a third division German side, and Newcastle laboured for a bit of that. And I think there was a few reasons. First of all,
yeah,
a lot of the players went to it quite fatigued because of the work they'd done during the week. Howe has talked about tapering down training going towards Portugal. This was the really intense block, and the training was almost more important than the game, other than what they were going to get from it tactically. But in terms of the performance, wasn't necessarily as important. And then second of all, the heat affected them, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And 1860 sort of sat in a low block. But then the last half an hour, when Newcastle brought on their internationals, they're really, who only play the final half an hour, the likes of Bruno Guimaraes, and they really, really stepped it up from that point, and Kieran Trippier and the like. And it was a comfortable win in the end. And obviously, we saw Nick Pope and Sven Botman for the first time.
We did.
And Pope started that match. Howe was adamant not to read too much into it in terms of that means he's in line to be number one. Dubravka started the next game, and then they switched and did the final half an hour. But Pope looked solid. He only had one real save to make, but it was a good one. Mm. What I think was noticeable was how much he was using his feet to play it short. Very un-Burnley-esque, as we were talking about the other week. So he's already working on that. And then Sven Botman came on a little bit earlier than intended, came on at half-time, because Jamal Lascelles had received a bit of a kick in the first half, and just as a precaution. So he initially came on as a right-sided centre-back, and alongside Dan Byrne. Then on the hour mark, shifted across to left-sided centre-back and played with Fabian Scher. So it's interesting to see that already he has been tested in that position, even if it was more necessity rather than out of plan.
I was impressed with Botman George. I thought he looked solid, comfortable on the ball. He's a big, tall lad. He looks strong. And I mean, the entire team look pretty fit, don't they? But it was nice to see those new signings getting a run out.
Couldn't really give a toss. I haven't watched a single second of it. Not really interested in pre-season friendlies at all. Absolutely couldn't give a toss.
Oh, God, I'm so glad you're back.
The thing that I want to talk about, though, is, I mean, no one likes the grass, obviously, but Chris has just been sending me a long series of photographs of him drinking beer, eating various Austrian, Germanic meat products, cycling everywhere, wearing his shorts. It's just been one big long jolly for Chris, who doesn't fancy the South Coast, as we established.
You're still bitter about the Brighton
thing,
aren't you? You really are.
But one very nice thing that Chris has done whilst he's been over there is that he hosted a meet and greet for Athletic subscribers, which all Athletic writers who've been on tour with their respective clubs have been asked to do. So tell us about that, Chris. How did that go?
I think I might leave the podcast at this stage. There was only one person who turned up, so that was how successful it was. I mean, I had fear when I'll give a bit of context to this. So we were asked about 10 days ago to put together an email for all Athletic reporters who were going away on pre-seasons. About 10 of us, I think. And the likes of Man United have gone somewhere, I think they're in Australia somewhere, and Everton are in Washington, D.C. And what you can do is you can target an email to a very specific geographic location for where you've got subscribers from. And it turns out that we don't have many subscribers who are based in Salfelden in Austria. There wasn't as many Newcastle fans came across for the first game, actually, as I was a bit surprised that I thought there'd be a few more fans, but again, I think there was a few reasons for that. I think how late it was.
It's a tough place to get to.
How late the game was confirmed. Also, that the fans who had come in for it, I think some had left to go to Salzburg or elsewhere and moved on. I'm trying to make myself feel better here, by the way. But yes, it was in the sense only one person turned up was an unmitigated disaster. But yes, I do love you all. So the fans, the fans who I met in the hotel on the Friday, because before Friday, I thought there's probably going to be nobody turning up yet. A couple of fans who were staying in my hotel said to me, "Oh, Chris, we'll be at your thing tomorrow night." So at that point, suddenly my confidence level shot up and I thought, "Ee, that's going to be at least half a dozen people. This will be great." No. No, that was a... So whoever that was, thank you for bare-faced lying to me.
Didn't even get his name?
No.
You didn't even get the lad's name?
Well, clearly because you just lied to us, you probably didn't want to give his name across either, so yeah. But in terms of... To pick up on your point about Meet George, I never thought I would say this, but actually, I think I've had my fill for the last few days. What's been very odd is that in German... It seems that German and Austrian places, they're really like Greek restaurants. Everywhere we've been just about, there's been a Greek restaurant, there's been like the main restaurant of place. I've had some Austrian sausages as well, but there's been a lot of Greek meat. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry about that,
which
Chris.
Is going to be the title for this podcast, lot of Greek meat.
I apologise for that, Chris, but I couldn't really resist. Anyway, I think the important thing at this stage is that it is all about fitness. It's about integrating players. Mm. It's about team spirit. It's about teamwork and it's about sweat, really. I don't honestly think anything else matters. But that's not to say that pre-season isn't very, very important. And I'm delighted that Chris is there for us and he's produced some kind of great stuff. But in terms of drawing conclusions from, sweeping conclusions from friendly matches, I've never done that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because you don't see the team at full tilt. But obviously the team looks strong and they look fit. And I thought the pressing, Chris, was really intense, especially in the second game against Mainz, when Mainz kind of dropped right off in the second half and the pressing was just relentless, wasn't it? Newcastle had a few chances. Callum Wilson had a shot saved by that young goalkeeper's face. And it was, Newcastle were unlucky not to come away with something. But again, it's the same story, isn't it? They're profligate up front and they don't seem to be able to put the chances away at the minute.
Yeah, I've written about that. It's on The Athletic now about how the Hugo Ekitike failure to sign him has sort of affected their summer plans for bringing in forwards. And at the minute, they really aren't anywhere in terms of who they're trying to bring. They really aren't close to anything and they are having to reassess things. And that's where you can see the lack in the final third. Howe said after the game when we pushed him on it that they've obviously been working on everything, but now that they're focused on certain points at different points of pre-season, now the focus will shift to the final third and trying to get more out of who they have, because for the first two-thirds of the pitch you can see where they have developed. You can see they're playing a higher line, albeit they've been against opposition who've tried to sit back a little bit from them, but they're trying to push higher, they're trying to retain the ball a little bit more, and they are pressing from the front, and that intensity's gone up even more than last season. You can also see the change in approach. The midfield, the wider midfielders in the midfield three, whoever that may be who's playing there, they're actively looking to overlap and underlap the forwards, create an overload into the box, and so you can see what Newcastle are trying to work on. It just hasn't quite clicked in attack yet, and they could do with a little bit of ingenuity, because Alan Saint-Maximin, I think he's had a couple of little niggles during pre-season and he hasn't quite set a light yet. But as George said, you can't read too much into these matches, but equally I still think, given we know that Newcastle struggled a little bit with goals last season, the fact they haven't added anyone in attack yet and that's been the priority throughout does remain a little bit of a concern as to how they really do improve that going forward.
There's no panic from the club though, is there, as far as the hierarchy are concerned? There are striker targets going elsewhere. Armando Breuer's apparently close to a deal with West Ham. But the club are not panicking, and neither should we, really, should we?
No, it's not a sense of panic. I think it's more a sense of frustration with the market as much as anything else. Howe spoke about the Ekitike deal, and he was sort of quite philosophical about it, trying to almost make a positive out of the fact, look, this is the calibre of player we're going for, this is the calibre of club we're competing against.
Yeah.
And the budget Newcastle have remaining means that they probably can't sign two players of the quality they necessarily want permanently anyway, in terms of a right winger and a centre forward, unless they can get some sort of decent deal negotiated elsewhere. And so that they are trying to be savvy in terms of what they do. They may use the Premier League loan market towards the end of the window when players become available. But for now, they're not panicking, but I do think they would like to see progress in that regard. They just feels like they need something fresh, although the one player who really is benefiting from the lack of transfer activity and has been given the chance that Eddie Howe told him he would be given during pre-season is Elliot Anderson, who I think has really caught the eye of quite a few people. He's shown he's physically grown in stature as well. I remember he was previously quite a slight individual. He's bulked up. That you can see he's done that in his League Two, his time at Bristol Rovers in League Two, but also his game has come on a heck of a lot, and he's the one bright spark. Howe picked him out against 1860 Munich. I thought we saw flashes again when he came on against Mainz, that he's someone who, it's interesting because he's been playing on the left of the midfield three when he's been playing, but when Newcastle have possession, it's almost become like a 4-2-3-1. Willock drops a little bit deeper to join Shelvey, and Anderson goes in the pockets behind the striker, and it's just interesting to see what he can bring. And Howe, if for now, has said that he's going to stick around, and it depends on A, what they do in the market, and B, whether Anderson is going to play regularly. But I don't think he's done himself any harm whatsoever so far.
Has that been another dog shouting at you in the background, Chris?
That's outside my window of my kitchen. There's a dog barking in the back garden,
shouting,
and then next door, there's somebody dog shouting in the back garden. So, Chris, another player who's in an upbeat mood and has been enjoying that training camp is John Joe Shelvey, and we're going to hear a little bit from him now.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I mean, obviously, we went through a really bad spell, haven't we? Just 6.5 years now. And you know what the crack is around the city and what you kind of can't do and stuff like that now. So it's a really good place to be at the minute. The city's buzzing. I mean, Mar, Mrs. and kids, they love it up there. So it's just a great place to be, and everyone wants to be involved in it.
You want to be here longer than your current contract?
Yeah, I've got 3 games to make to get another year.
Yeah.
Hopefully I should do that this year. I mean, I'd be a bit worried if I didn't. But obviously, I'm, at the end of the day, you're always bad for a new contract, you know what I mean? I'm not thick, I'm not getting any younger. I'm 30 years of age, and I look about 46. But you just want to be part of it at the end of the day. It's the only way this club is looking is up, and I think everyone would like to be in my shoes.
Yeah, so a very trim-looking John Joe Shelvey. Actually, it's almost—I almost think he looks a little bit. It's bizarre. He looks a little bit too thin. He looks different in the face. He looks almost skeletal. I think he said he'd lost 32 millimeters. You know, in the pinch test.
Wow.
Or in terms of fat of this way, he went to Turkey. He's been working really hard to try and get himself fit. He said how Eddie Howe has driven standards so much. He talked about defensively. He feels that Howe has brought him on a heck of a lot, and that he knows that he just has to keep raising his level, not just because Newcastle are pushing on, but the Premier League and football in general.
Yeah.
And it was refreshing to hear from somebody. He's very open and honest when we don't get to interview Shelvey very often, but when we do, he is always a very good talker and he will answer questions. He revealed that he's only 3 games away from an automatic extension for another 12 months, because his contract initially was due to be up next summer. If he plays 3 games, he's going to go to 2024. But he's basically said, I'm not just happy with that. I know I'm getting on, but I want to stay at Newcastle. I want to be part of this as long as possible. He says he backs himself against anyone. He talked about the quality of Bruno Guimaraes and the others, but he said, I believe I can be as good as anyone. I will challenge myself against anyone. And he just sounds so driven and so determined, and I think it'll be fascinating to see which midfield three does start, because Newcastle have strength and depth there. Sean Longstaff has looked good in pre-season so far. He looks very fit as well. Joe Willock, it gives something a little bit different. Newcastle have quite a lot of options in there, even with Elliot Anderson as someone else who can play in that midfield.
Which is 100% what you want. I mean, Shelvey obviously played a very important role in Newcastle's unbeaten run in the second half of last season.
Yeah.
Whatever you think about him as a player, whatever you think about the other players who've been here, for a while, you want them to be driven on by what's happened post-takeover to get better. We saw that in the second half of last season. It's fantastic that Shelvey is busting a gut to get fit, to get fitter, to be trimmer and leaner, to push on in midfield. It's exactly the kind of attitude you need around the camp. So that's very heartening.
Let's move on. We're going to have a bit of chat about Darren Eales and also another special guest very soon. So So, chaps, we had an announcement late last week that the search for a CEO is finally over. Chris, Darren Eales has been appointed from Atlanta, and a name that came out of the blue a little bit. It must be a relief to the club, and it must be a relief to everybody involved that we've now got the man in place that we wanted. We spoke about this recently on the pod, that the appointment hadn't been made, but now Darren Eales is in place.
Yeah, I mean, it came out of the blue publicly, and I'm not trying to be wise after the fact. It was a name which we had heard at The Athletic a few weeks ago. We had tried to check it out. My colleague Felipe Cardenas, who we had on the podcast before, who is close at Atlanta United, we'd sort of tried to get it firmed up. We didn't get enough information to be able to write the story as strongly as we would have wanted to, so didn't put it out there. But it is a very interesting choice. This CEO search has gone on for a long while. Newcastle, I think, have been close on previous occasions to getting towards someone, and then for whatever reason it hasn't happened. It's been delayed,
yeah.
And they've gone for someone who Newcastle have had dealings with before. People may remember his name when Miguel Almiron signed for Newcastle, because he was the Atlanta United president. He was the one who negotiated the deal. Steve Nixon had a lot of dealings with him, and it's an interesting choice, because I think that the people were thinking they were going to go for sort of big hitters around Europe. I mean, Ivan Gazidis was someone who was linked, former Arsenal director, who's now at AC Milan, and instead they've gone for Eales, who I think his real success story, if you look at it, and we will be doing a big piece on this on the Athletic in the coming days and weeks, is really commercially what he has done to that club. He really started them off from nothing, and now they have one of the best stadia in the world. They've won the MLS, but they really are very good at the commercial dealings and revenue, and that's really where Newcastle need to expand. So it'll be fascinating to see what he can do. This was the second executive appointment they needed on top of Dan Ashworth, and they've finally got it done, so that's a real positive.
George, Darren Eales is, he's an Essex boy, studied at Brown University, played soccer over there. To what level, we're not entirely sure, but he returned to England, studied at Cambridge, and he's also been involved at West Brom. What exactly have Newcastle got with Darren Eales here? Is he someone who you think can push the club forward?
Yeah, and obviously at West Brom he worked with Dan Ashworth, so that's an important kind of link to make. I mean, if we take a step back, it has taken a long time for them to get this position sorted. But at the end of it, they've got themselves, and you know, there has been criticism along the way about the time it's taken to make decisions. But you know, I would like to pay a bit of tribute to the people running the club, because at the end of it, Newcastle have got a really serious, sensible manager in Eddie Howe.
Yep.
They've made a very serious technical appointment in Dan Ashworth. And although I know less about Darren Eales, as Chris says, his track record in America in building a club from scratch has been exemplary. They have not gone for the stardust kind of names that we were sort of, you know, might have thought at the start of this. They haven't been seduced by that. They haven't been seduced by the sort of fame and that side of it, which we thought might happen with players as well. And Newcastle suddenly feel like a sensible, serious, forward-thinking football club. And I just think that's amazing. I mean, I think that's brilliant. And so I'm very excited to see what Darren Eales can do. I want us to play this little clip. This takes us back to February, when I sat down with Amanda Staveley and Mehrdad Gadousi, and we were talking about what the CEO would bring when he or she eventually arrived. And at the start of this clip, Mehrdad is actually, he was talking initially about the sporting director, and then he moved on to talk about what they wanted from a CEO.
And then secondly, to bring on a CEO who has a vision about making a successful, sustainable business within the club. And that's driving commercial revenues, because commercial revenues means more money for the club, which means the club can invest more into its infrastructure, into its squad, into every other aspect of it. These are all kind of simple things, but when you put it into place, will create an incredible output. This is part of our plans going forward.
So the CEO's role isn't, we don't want just a CEO that's been at another Premier League club that is going to just say, okay, this is what we did before, this is what you do, and this is what I think you, and this is what I'm going to continue to do. We want someone who will come in and really challenge the status quo and look at the business from many different angles, because we think the Premier League will change. It has to. In there'll be more challenge. It's done an incredibly good job of attracting sponsorship.
Yeah.
But we're moving into a new digital area where NFTs and different commerce are coming in, which gives the clubs massive opportunities for revenue, but that has to be well thought through.
Yeah.
We do not want our club to be selling products to fans that aren't suitable and disparate. You know, we just have to really think about what our fans want, and they have to also have value for money. So we want a commercial, we want a, sorry, a chief executive that can help us really grow this as a global brand and really put Newcastle on the global map.
Yeah, yeah.
And that doesn't mean to say that Murdy and I will step back, because we won't. We'll just all remain working 100% of our time still on it, you know, but we'll just have more people to do the work.
So, Chris, it feels like the parts are starting to fall into place. The Dan Ashworth appointment was a big one, and this one with Darren Eales seems like a big one as well. One of the things that's really impressed me about Darren Eales, I've watched a couple of little clips and interviews with him, and the way he talks about football fans and how they are essential to the business model and how they are so important, and he seems to be really on board with fan engagement and making sure that fans are happy going forward. And I mean, this is not something we're used to with Newcastle United, is it? Because the last fella couldn't give two fucks about the fans, and we knew that for 14 years or whatever it was. But Darren Eales seems to be someone who's interested in and committed to fan engagement going forward.
Yeah, as you say, it's the polar opposite of what we've seen previously. I mean, I think it's slightly different, because in US sports, that has to be the way that you are. You have to be a little bit more outward facing. So it'll be interesting to see how much of that translates across to Newcastle. Yeah. He was at West Brom previously when Dan Ashworth was there. He then sort of rose up the ranks. He went to Spurs and worked with Daniel Levy, so he got experience there before he went across to Atlanta United. He's also on the board at Aberdeen, so he has links there. I don't know whether he's going to have to resign that position yet or not. We're going to try and find out. But that fan engagement, I hope to see that will be built up and to get more supporters involved. But whether it directly correlates from what happened in Atlanta to moving it across the Premier League, it is slightly different.
Yeah.
But equally, I think that we will see progress in that area, because it certainly wouldn't be hard from the previous ownership. But there is still work to go, as well as the current owners have done. I still think with so much that needs to be built up off the pitch, a new CEO will really help to do that and hopefully make it an outward looking club once again.
And just to go back to Newcastle's email when they announced his appointment, they say that Over the time he spent at Atlanta, he's built a franchise that secured the highest average attendance in MLS, created the most valuable squad, generated the largest profits, and won multiple trophies. That's exactly the kind of journey Newcastle are looking to go on, to grow absolutely every part of the club, not to just spend money. It's about generating money. It's about making money, money that can then be reinvested back into the club in terms of infrastructure, in terms of playing, and all the rest of it. It's a massive, massive role. People close to the takeover were saying from day one, Newcastle can't really develop properly until this appointment comes in, because this appointment is the key to all of that stuff.
Absolutely, and what way to finish this? What better way to finish this than to hear from the man himself? Newcastle United, Darren Eales says, is both a giant of a club and the heartbeat of its community. I've been overwhelmed by the passion of the fans, and I'm delighted to be joining for this new chapter in its long history. There we go. Smart words from Darren Eales, and welcome to Newcastle United. Don't forget, you can subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 a month for the first 6 months right now. Go to theathletic.com/NewcastlePod and you get full access to all of our great writing and ad-free versions of The Athletic's podcasts. That's theathletic.com/NewcastlePod. Sign up now. We're going to switch over to Zoom now, and we'll be back in just a moment with Newcastle United physio Derek Wright. Back in a sec. So, a week after welcoming one of Newcastle's great entertainers to the pod, we have another legend amongst us. For 38 years, this man has been Newcastle's physio, agony aunt, the priest of the treatment room, friend and confidant of players, and a keeper of the club's flame. At last count, he'd worked under 31 managers, permanent, temporary, or interim. Recently, he's announced his retirement. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Derek Wright. Hello, Derek. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing? Are you good?
I'm all right. Yes, I'm. It's slightly strange, but it's
it's nice in a way as well, you know, not having to sort of worry about the stress of the day ahead. So it is, it's strange, but I'm getting used to it a little bit, I think.
So why now? Why was now the right time for you to retire?
I think it was something which we discussed at the end of last season, really. I mentioned last year that I'd probably sort of retire in the next couple of years. I thought it was the right time, and maybe I went to 40 years or when I was 66. But I think once I sort of got it in my head and I kept on talking about it and I couldn't help it. Now I was thinking, right, there, you need to shut up and not tell people you're retiring here. But it was one of those things which once it was there,
yeah,
I was thinking this is the right time. And I think they were aware that they had to, you know, prepare for my successor.
Yeah.
So we were looking at that as well. We were looking at sort of new head physios, people that could take over. Do we advertise? Do we headhunt? That type of thing. And it was just a discussion then after the end of last season. And then it was just, right, I think this is the right time, really. The idea initially was to sort of have some sort of transition from me to the new head physio, but I think, and I said as well, I didn't think that was really the best idea. I couldn't, you know, imagine coming in as head physio myself, and there's Derek Wright in the corner of the treatment room, pottering around, and
yeah.
You know, I thought, well, no, I don't think that's right. And we agreed, and so we thought we'd sort of do it now, really.
Well, before we have a lot of stories that we want to get out of you, if you don't mind. But we also want to make a bit of fuss of you. And before we start properly, I kind of just want to say, too, that you really are, you're an icon at the club, and this is the end of an era. You're a very, very special person. I've known you for a long time. But I think the biggest thing I want to say kind of about you is that, you know, there's been some tough times at the club over the last decade and more, but it's knowing that you're there and you're there striving for excellence and you're there as a great fella, but great at what you do, has made me feel confident that the club was still in safe hands. And it gave me a connection to the club and to the team when sort of every other part of the club was driving me away from that. So I want to say huge thank you for your service and everything you've done. We're very privileged we get a chance to do this. But to say thank you, and thank you for keeping the spirit of the club alive for so long.
No, that's very, very kind words. Thank you very much. I think it's just I think it's the way you've been brought up as well. As a youngster, my dad always used to say to me, look, you just 100%, doesn't matter what happens, you work hard, head down, be honest, you know, all the sort of good sort of values, really. And I think and still is a lot of good people at the club, a lot of people who have been there a long time. And, you know, even in these sort of frustrating years, we would chat amongst ourselves, and people are grafters, really, there, you know, I mean, people who've been there as long as me, and you've just got to work hard and graft away. And I think it was the thought of, yes, this one day this will get better, because I think it does go in cycles. And I remember Arthur Cox saying to me when the time when Kevin Keegan was there, he said to me and Ray Thompson, look, you know, enjoy this period, because this will not happen, might not happen again, or it might not happen for a very long time. And me and Ray, after Arthur went out, just looked at each other and went, what's he talking about? You know, it was like, surely this is going to be the way it is for the next 30, 40 years. And
yeah.
But it wasn't, you know, and it was one of those where we were appreciative after a period of time. We knew what Arthur was talking about, really. Those great times don't come along that often, and you have to really enjoy them.
All right, well, we were going to ask you this a bit later on, but seeing as you brought it up, it feels like the best time to do it. We'll come back to kind of talk a bit about your earlier career. But when we had John Beresford on last week, and he was talking about the similarities between the Keegan era, the start of the Keegan era, really, and now. that there is that feeling of reinvigoration around the club. There's been a takeover, there's a new manager, there's new players come in, and there's that huge feeling of momentum behind the club and the city. Do you feel those parallels as well?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you could feel that straight away where it was announced the takeover was there, and all the supporters were down the ground, and the feeling next day of going into work, and we were all excited, really, you know. I mean, you don't know what's coming, and you don't know, but it's, you knew that it was the start of something different, start of something special. And I was just pleased for the fans, really, because, I mean, there's staff. It's a bit strange, really, because you know this is going on, but the next day and the day after is just like a normal day at work. You've just got to
continue. You just have to crack back on, don't you?
In routine, and, you're talking about with players and with staff, but you knew something different was happening. Definitely, I mean, that was for sure, you know. I remember one of the physios coming in to me and saying, right, Derek, what can we buy now, you know, that's like equipment-wise. And I went, well, I don't think it's as simple as that, really, because, if you're not careful, you're like a kid in a sweet shop and you want to buy everything, you know. But it was that feeling, you know, it was like, oh, this could be the opportunity of, you know, improving everything and getting what we, you know, what we want, really.
And Derek, Newcastle was always your club, wasn't it? But in your earlier career, you actually signed for Arsenal originally as an apprentice fullback. Is that right?
Yes, I used to travel down from Stanley. I remember getting picked up from school on a Friday by taxi when I was at school, taken to the station, going down and playing in the Southeast Counties League at Arsenal, and staying the next day, getting the train back. And I was only about 14, 15 year old then, about 15. And it was, you know, I sound like a really grumpy old dad with my boys, because I say to them, look, I was living in London when I was 16. Get yourself up again. So it was like, it was one of those where it was Arsenal were a fantastic club to play for, and they were, you know, I won't, you know, my memories there were brilliant, really. I didn't make it. I wasn't good enough, really, but I think I was nearly, you know, I was in among my era was Frank Stapleton and, you know, David O'Leary, Graham Ricks, Liam Brady, you know, that sort of era, and they sort of went on, a lot of them went on to make the grade. It was a little bit different then. They used to sort of, you signed schoolboy forms and you went down every holiday. So I was traveling down to London all the time, really. But they were a great club. They did things right, and it sort of taught me a lot then about how to try and think about the right way to do things, you know. And they were great to play for, and I never made it. But
so you went away, you retrained, and one of the connections you'd made at Arsenal was actually with Malcolm McDonald, wasn't it? And you came back to, he asked you back to London, you went to Fulham. And when I say that you did everything at Fulham, can you please explain what that meant?
Yeah, I mean, I was only 23 when I was first team physio. Well, I was the only physio for the whole club. And I remember going down, being in Diggs the night before and having all my sports medicine books and thinking, this is just completely, you know, I'd worked in the health service for 2 years and thinking this is completely different. I was quite sort of nervous, apprehensive, but like sort of excited. And the next day, you know, I remember running onto the pitch when I hadn't even been called on by the referee, and sort of like being ordered off. I was that excited, you know, so it was great. That was a great little club. I mean, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed my time there.
But sorry to interrupt, but you also registered as a player, weren't you? So you were playing for the reserves, but then also treating the same players. That's what I meant.
Well, I was 20, like I say, I was 23, and I hadn't made it in Arsenal, but I could still play. And Terry Mancini was the reserve team manager, and Terry said, right, Derek, you might as well, because I did the reserves and the first team. And he said, you know, make sure that you get straight. And anyway, I played one of the games, and then he started picking me for the reserves. So, you know, I started playing the reserves, and if anybody got injured, the coach driver was in the dugout with my bag.
My God.
I used to run off. Well, the first game, I said to the coach driver, come on with the bag. I thought that would work, but then he came on with the... It was when you had the bucket and sponge. He came on with the bucket and sponge, and the water was splashing all over the place. There was so I just said, look, you stay there. I'll run off, get the bag, and run back on. And then, you know, the players were looking and...
Amazing.
It's true. And when I started to actually treat the players as well, it was just right, run off, put the bag off, and thanks, ref, and carry on the game, you know. So,
like, I'm amazed you didn't run on one day with a bus driver sandwiches in the bag. Put the wrong bag up.
The bus driver was so excitable, so I had to keep him in the dugout for after that. But we played one of the games, and Terry told me after Frank Clark was manager of Orient, I think, at the time. We played at Watford, and he came to watch the game, and he came down to one inquired about me as a player. And Terry Mancini said, no, you can't take him. He's our physio, you know. So he's like, I think I didn't know if he was, if Frank was a little bit embarrassed that he was, he wanted to take the other team's physio rather than the player, really.
What about returning back to Newcastle United? That must have been a bit of a dream come true under Jack Charlton and coming back to the club that you loved as a boy and stuff like that. It must have been an amazing feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it was through old Dr. Beveridge, really. Dr. Beveridge was the club doctor at the time, and he was a GP, but a lovely man, very, very good GP, very good doctor who had an interest in sports medicine. He rang me when I was at Fulham and said, look, would I be interested? He knew I was from the northeast. He knew someone who'd worked with me in the health service at Northumberland. And I went for an interview at the hotel with Jack and the doc, and that was it. Yes, I got Jack was never talked about the job, just talked about fishing and, you know, football. And that was it, really. Nothing about physiotherapy, basically, or the medical side. And he just said, right, you're a young physio, but you'll grow up with a young team. I always remember him saying that to me. And that was, so when I came to Newcastle, I mean, I was like the likes of Glenn Rowe to Kenny Wharton, Peter Beardsley with the players, and they were great. I mean, I was only 26 when I came as head physio, and that was the lads at that time were really, really, they took me under their wing a little bit, really. And I think they realised I was only young, and they were very friendly, very sort of accommodating. You know.
And I mean, again, back then you did pretty much everything then as well. You were physio for the first team reserves, the kids as well, I think. But I want to talk a little bit about the Jim Smith era, and you know exactly where I'm going to go with this, because you also had to, I mean, you did all the organising for the away trips, didn't you? You booked the accommodation, you did all that kind of stuff, and you were in charge.
Yeah.
You were in charge of the float for the away trips. So what I want you to explain, please, is what that meant under Jim Smith's management.
Well, the float was, I remember the float was £300 and the float covered everything from, I'll say, a couple of bottles of wine on a Friday night, of red wine, the fish and chips after the game, and everything that was, and I remember Tony used to say, Derek, where's the receipts, you know? And I would say, Tony, there's no receipts, you know, there's just no receipts. But there was... Yeah, Jim's red wine and the fish and chips. Well, I remember every game I used to take an order for the fish and chips, and we went to Blackburn, and I remember giving the fish and chip order to the man outside the dressing room. He used to order the fish and chips after the game at Blackburn. And I could tell this guy wasn't listening to what I was saying about the order and whatever like that. And Jim was in the middle of a pre-match team talk at full floor, and there was a knock on the door, and this old man came in from outside the dressing room, and he went, was it six fish or was it seven fish and chips or was it sausage? In the middle of Jim's team talk, and I'm thinking, oh my God. And I'll not tell you what Jim, yeah, you know, like just at the top of his voice. And with the poor little old man. I was saying, that's all right, just I tried to usher him out. And Jim was like, hey, you'd never forgive me for that.
Oh, it's amazing.
And obviously, nutrition has changed a lot since then, but also so has the job of the physio, except to say that I think you've always said that it's about the hands. You know, the job is about the hands, but it's also about the mind. And I did a big interview with you for the Times a few years ago. And so many of the players that I spoke to when I said that I was interviewing you, from Alan Shearer to Steve Harper to Steve Howie, said how important you were, not just because you were shit-hot at your sort of day job, but because you were this almost confessional figure. Because you see people at their lowest ebb. You see footballers when they can't play football, when they're not footballers anymore. And so you have to guide them. You were the person that kind of guided them through dark places. So you had this sort of dual responsibility, didn't you, to get them fit, but also mentally to kind of keep them right. You took that on your shoulders too.
Yeah, I think it's and I still do. You know, the game or our profession is in sport has changed dramatically, really. And you know, I have tried to, and I think I have prided myself in keeping up with the developments and research and everything like that, and you have to. But the most important thing, and I always say this to physios coming through, is that you have to listen. You have to work out the history of what's happened with them. You have to listen to them as human beings, and you have to. Your hands are important. You can have the best machines in the world and all the gadgets, but at the end of the day, you have to feel. You have to touch, you have to know what a injured muscle feels like, what a healing muscle feels like. But the most important thing is that they trust you, and that you know, if they say something to you, you're not going to blab it off to anybody or any of the other players. What they tell you is stays inside you, and you know, there's things that have been told me I would never tell anybody, you know, and I'll take to the grave. And that's, you know, but I think that has been a big part of it, really.
And Derek, we talked about a little bit about it before, about the Kevin Keegan era when he returned as manager, and it really reinvigorated the club, didn't it? And it was the time when I first started going watching football at St James's Park. I have very fond memories of it, of that sort of 92-93 season. And what must it have been like? What was it like being inside of that? It must have been a phenomenal feeling to see the club and the way it was changing and the takeoff that was possible.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I remember we played at Leicester, I think, where we could have gone down, couldn't we? And
yeah.
We didn't.
That's right, yeah.
And I remember just the feeling after that game, thinking, and then turning to Ray and saying, this is it. I think we're going to do really well. And the next year, and you know, the following years after that, it was just you felt as the feeling is that you're just never going to get. You're going in every game, and you think we're going to win this game. But you weren't winning just win the game. You were winning well. You know, there was goals flying in all over the place, and it was just, I don't know. You could tell the crowd as well were just like, it was a different feel. And the memories of that time was brilliant, really.
Right, well, now that we've got you on that, I'm afraid that you are contractually obliged now to tell us the Keegan fancy dress story.
I'll not tell you the first bit, but the second bit was the club, there was a club fancy dress, everybody, staff, not Kevin and Terry, I don't think, but the all the other staff. And there was, you know, everybody had to get a fancy dress. And I remember Paul Ferrer saying to me, Derek, you would look great as a pink fairy. And I was thinking, really? And then I started to think, you know what, I think I would. I would look great as a pink fairy, which is quite worrying, really. You know, so I got my pink fairy outfit and me Dr. Martens and everything like that. Anyway, I'd come back away from a weekend with when I'd taken Steve and Alan away, and things probably had got a little bit messy, should we say, and came back. Evan was calling Steve in first, and I remember just all the shouting and, you know, whatever like that, and Steve was in his emu costume, and the emu's head was bowed down in shame. And then I said to Paul Ferris, I said, there's no way I'm putting this pink fairy outfit on. Kevin's on one and he's going to go absolutely ballistic if I walk in there as a pink fairy. And Ferris went, you'll be all right, Derek. He's all right. He understands. You know? And Ray Thompson as well. Derek, you're fine. Don't worry. So then I went in the pink fairy into the room after Steve's emu's head had sort of walked out. And we just went, what the? And it was just like, he looked at Terry and he went on for a while and, you know, made me feel really ashamed of myself. And at the end went, just get out. And that was it. I remember just walking out, looking, I must have been the most shameful pink fairy that had ever sort of walked the planet. You know, I was just like ashamed of myself and Marie Antoinette wig and me wand and, you know, but you forget you've got this outfit on, really. And I just remember trudging out and then just everybody bursting out laughing. And then I just remember the little window, Kevin looking out the window, and all I could see was Kevin's eyes just sort of boring a hole through me, you know, sort of. And I thought, oh my God, it was just,
oh, amazing.
I won't go into the what Kevin said. That was probably between me and him. But I think he sort of has a little laugh about it since then, I think. But he rang me the other day, Kevin. Actually, he was really, really nice on the phone. And but I never brought the pink fairy out. That's for sure. But that pink fairy outfit, I won the prize for the best outfit.
Amazing.
After all that.
Derek, one of the things that kept getting mentioned on social media amongst fans was during your early days was racing opposition physios onto the pitch. This is something which has become kind of like your trademark back in the day. Where did this come from and what was it all about? I mean,
I just wanted to, initially, I mean, it was just to get on the field as quickly as possible. And I was a sprinter actually at school. I sort of up to sort of county standard and whatever like that. And so I knew I could sprint, but it was after the first couple of times I could hear this sort of woo, you know, like a yeah, when I went on, and I thought, right. And then it was a feeling of I can't get beat here. I kind of let the other physio beat me, which is quite childish, I know, but it was just ingrained in my mind that I was going to beat whoever it was, and that was it. And then the chain got louder and louder, and it was just going on. And I remember, but it was when I was going off the other side of the pitch and have a sort of a little laugh and with the fans, and it was just nice, really. I think it was just sort of a, you know, it was nice if you were winning. If you were getting beaten, you were, you know, they were still cheering. It was like, it was quite embarrassing, but it was that's all it was. It was just, I couldn't stop myself from racing at the end. Something inside of me, I had to win. That was it.
I'm trying to think about how I express this delicately in this modern world we live in, where you have to be very conscious about the words you use. But I mean, you're not a small man. I'm going to put it that way. And over the years, maybe I've done that completely wrong. Over the years, I mean, you've had this, you know, fantastic relationship with the players you work with. There have been certain beneficiaries to this, because you've had sort of bets, haven't you, over the course of seasons with players about losing weight and things like that, and it's where you've kept players engaged. And I think Alan Shearer's retirement fund, his pension fund, did pretty well out of you over the years, I think I'm right in saying. But also, more recently, you came quite close to having an unfortunate addition to your body, didn't you? And you own... Tell us a story about that. I think you probably know what I mean. And how close did you come?
you'd think I would learn my lesson, wouldn't you? But I've been roped in over the years. Right, Derek, come on, I'll bet you can lose 3 stone this season. And, right, come on, and I'll do it. Yeah, I'm sure my words on my gravestone are going to be, this is it, you know? Right, this is it. And I won against Kevin Keegan. I lost a couple to Alan where he sort of accepted the money, which I didn't think he would actually, but he did.
It was.
There was a lot of work going to the cash point machine. It was nearly being sick taking the money out. Then there was Stephen Taylor. If he won, he was going to use the paintball. I was dressed down to my underpants in the 6-yard box, running between the posts. And he had 50 paintballs where he could basically shoot them from the edge of the 18-yard box, which was going to be on YouTube at the same time. So I thought I was going to do this, and there was a day to go, and I was 12 pounds overweight. And I said to Jamie Harley, the sports scientist, says, Jamie, is it possible to lose 12 pounds in one day? And he went, well, it is, but it's not advisable and it's dangerous. I went, right, okay. I says, well, I'm going to do it, you know. So I ended up with various methods of sauna, steam room, treadmill, bike, you know, just for 24 hours. And I lost 12 pounds in one day.
Bloody hell.
I remember Teals coming in with all the equipment thinking he'd won. And I got on the scales and he went off and he thought I was cheating, for one thing. And he thought that the scales were wrong, and he just wouldn't believe that I'd lost this 12, because he knew I was 12 pounds overweight. And what made it worse was Liz, the chef, she had a big tray of bacon and egg sandwiches in the background. All I could smell were these bacon and egg sandwiches, and the scales weren't working properly. And I was getting hangry, and I was like, Jimmy, get these scales working, please. You know, it's like, I need these scales. And as soon as the 12 pounds was lost, that was it. I was just diving into the bacon and egg sandwiches after that. But Scales was gutted. He lost that. Then the last one was with Matt Ritchie. He was going to get a tattoo of himself on my backside if I'd lost. But again, left everything for the last moment, and I managed to do it. So I did win that one as well. But you know what happens when you do these stupid bets, and as the people in, you know, in the right jobs and professions will tell you, it's the wrong thing to do. So I don't advise doing this.
No.
And you just end up putting all the weight back on again. And so, you know, it's not advisable, really. We kept everybody happy for 38 years.
Well, I was going to say, we're telling these stories over 38 years. Over those 38 years, you're entitled to a few funny stories. And no, the point is you've stayed at the club for so long because you're shit hot at what you do. But that relationship with footballers is obviously such a huge part of the job. We use that phrase, safe hands. They've been your hands. Players have been in safe hands, but in that way that I spoke about at the start, the club has been in safe hands with people like you around and people like Tony Toward, and you mentioned Ray as well. To know that and feel that the people at the club connect back, connect with us, connect everybody around, and you've taken that responsibility so seriously. You know, we have had a laugh, we've told some funny stories, and, you know, that's been a great pleasure to hear that. But the serious part is that, as I said, you've been connected to the club for so long because you've been really, really good at your job, always pushing for better. So I suppose the final question we need to ask is, What's next? How are you going to spend your retirement? Presumably, you'll still be engaged with the club. And did you get a good send off from Eddie Howe and the rest?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was Eddie invited me back in to say goodbye properly to the players and staff, which I did, which was, I managed to hold it together. But it was nice, really, because it was like a final, you know, it was like a bit of a closure for me to say thank you to them, really. I think there's the talking about a presentation or a something like that. But it was for me. I am looking forward to spending time with my family. I need to give them something back. I mean, Helen's been brilliant over the years. She's, you know, she's had to put up with me through all the sort of, you know, the struggling times as well, really. have time with the boys, and I'm gonna have some connection. I may do a little bit of work at the, you know, with the academy or the women's team or something like that. There is going to be a connection there still, but I'm keen on my job. I'm not going to stop physiotherapy. I'm keen on MSK ultrasound. I find it really interesting, and so I'm trying to do a lot of reading still and things like that. So there is, you know, I've got to keep, I can't just stop work. I mean, I said to Helen the other day, you know, what worried me initially was something like I would be Brooks off Shawshank Redemption. And, you know, when he was let out of prison and he sort of ended up packing the shopping in sort of Tesco or somewhere. And I just thought, no, I've got to keep working. I cannot stop. You know, I've just got to keep going, and I need to lose weight.
No more bets.
Derek, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us. It's been brilliant chatting with you. And 38 years as the club's physio, and I think it's obvious that your commitment to the club and to the job was never wavered. You've been a brilliant servant of the club all these years, and it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thanks very much, mate, for coming on. We really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Ah, George, that was great, wasn't it? What a fantastic bloke and an amazing servant of the club as well.
Just a brilliant... my voice is breaking there.
Oh, wow, what are you
it's
there?
It's about time. Ooh. About time my voice broke. I feel emotional. I mean, I feel emotional about him leaving.
Yeah.
Because as I said to him, it's, you know, he has been that connection through good times and bad. Those people at the club, they are the fabric of the club, you know, but it's also about excellence. You know, he, as he said, he came to the club at the time when it was a bucket and a sponge. And, you know, he's stayed there because he's been able to adapt and to develop, and he's developed the physio department. I've visited him in there when I interviewed him, and it's, you know, obviously it's incredibly technical now and advanced, and will only get better under the new owners. But it all comes down to personality and the hands and the fact he is a great bloke, the fact he's able to treat people mentally as well as physically. He has been an agony aunt for players, for generations of players. He will be sorely, sorely missed. One of the great characters of Newcastle's recent history.
38 years as well. Some career, that, isn't it?
Astonishing.
An incredible service. Yep. Absolutely amazing. Thank you so much, Derek, for coming on and talking to us. And congratulations on his retirement as
Indeed.
Well. A well-deserved rest ahead for him, I'm sure. Right then, that's everything. We're going to sign off now, chaps. Chris is away somewhere. He's probably pilfering somebody else's breakfast in Austria. Thanks a lot for listening to Pod on the Tyne again. Don't forget, you can subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 a month for the first 6 months at theathletic.com/NewcastlePod. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to Chris for joining us from Austria, and thanks to Derek as well for coming on and telling us some amazing stories. That's it. We'll be back next week. Take it easy. Bye bye.
The Athletic.